after a hectic week of negotiations, the $2 trillion coronavirus rescue package is a done deal. Plus, how the pandemic is changing police work.
It's kind of a hard situation. It's just a job you can't do from home and you can't do from 6 feet away.
It's Friday, March 27th. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Here's what's news. President Trump has signed a $2 trillion stimulus bill into law. It's the biggest economic relief package in U.S. history. Earlier in the day, the House passed the bill with a voice vote.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted.
The bill provides direct payments to Americans and expanded unemployment insurance. It provides loans and grants to businesses and state governments, and it sends resources to healthcare providers fighting the coronavirus. The Senate passed the legislation unanimously earlier this week. Wall Street Journal reporter Natalie Andrews says the bill represents a rare moment of bipartisan agreement.
It caps off 10 days of just insane late nights, back and forth, drafts being traded of the bill, not knowing quite what was in it until the Senate went to vote on it. I mean, senators got the copy of this 880-page bill minutes before they voted on it, though many of them had been involved in negotiations, so they were aware of what was going on. And then the House went up and passed it. It was almost kind of like a jolting end to a tumultuous week, but they did applaud. And members universally, Republicans and Democrats, while they may say they don't agree with every aspect of the bill, they recognize that this is a very important time to get relief to the country.
Prior to President Trump's signing of the stimulus bill, U.S. stocks closed down for the day, but they still managed to hang on to strong weekly gains. The Dow fell more than 900 points on Friday, or about 4%, but a weekly gain of 14% made it the index's best week since 1938. President Trump says he's ordering General Motors to start making ventilators to deal with a nationwide surge of coronavirus patients. Officials said the company and the White House had been discussing a contract worth about $1 billion, but the talks broke down over how quickly the devices could be made. Trump has been relying on a wartime law to spur companies to make necessary medical equipment. In the UK, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is confining himself to his residence for a week after testing positive for the coronavirus.
I am working from home, I'm self-isolating, and that's entirely the right thing to do. But be in no doubt that I can continue, thanks to the wizardry of modern technology, to communicate with all my top team to lead the national fight back against coronavirus.
Johnson is the first leader of a major Western nation to say they have the virus. The diagnosis raises the possibility that many of the key players in Britain's fight against the disease have been exposed. Worldwide, there are now more than 586,000 confirmed coronavirus cases, according to Johns Hopkins University, and more than 26,800 people have died. Coming up, we'll take a look at how the virus has changed the work of law enforcement across America. The coronavirus pandemic is changing nearly all aspects of American society. City by city, street by street, some of the people feeling the changes the most are the nation's law enforcement officers. As Americans isolate themselves at home and cities go quiet, police officers are still on the job. They're having to take precautions to keep themselves safe. And on the other side, officials are concerned that prisons could become petri dishes for the virus and have been taking precautions as well. Joining me now to talk more about how the pandemic has changed law and order across the country are Wall Street Journal reporters Zusha Ellenson and Ben Chapman. More than a dozen states, including New York and California, have released prisoners to stem the spread of the coronavirus. Ben, you're in New York and Zusha, you're in California. Can you tell us how this plan is working in your respective states? Zusha, let's start with you.
All right. So as this coronavirus outbreak started, jail officials knew they were going to have a huge problem on their hands because a lot of these jails are very crowded. Prisoners are jammed into cells, they're jammed into common areas, dining rooms, everything. It's very hard to social distance in jail. So one of the things they started thinking about early on is, can we release some of these lower level offenders or older people or sickly inmates so that we can free up some space for quarantines and just keep some space between the inmates? And so what they started doing is lowering bail for people who are, you know, have yet to gone to trial. So letting people out on lowered bail, and then also quickly reaching plea deals with lower level offenders to let them out early. And so we've seen that in more than a dozen states, you know, thousands of people have been let out of jails early. And so far, in terms of the impact on crime, we haven't seen it yet. In the major cities in the U.S., crime has actually been down in the first couple weeks of the lockdown.
And Ben, what about here in New York? We're having the same challenges balancing public safety with health of both prisoners and the general population.
That's right. The authorities in New York are very concerned about the outbreak of the virus at the city's jails, including Rikers Island, and they've taken steps to release a few hundred prisoners from Rikers already, and they're also declining to prosecute low-level offenses in an attempt to send fewer people into the jail. And that's what they're doing to slow the spread of the virus there. As far as the public safety concerns, the decisions to release inmates are joint decisions that are made by the mayor, the district attorneys, judges, and the police, among other entities. And they're really balancing the risk to the inmates. You know, do they have underlying conditions? Are they older? Are they likely to be, in serious trouble if they are infected with the virus, with the possibility of that person committing additional crimes or committing crimes at all if they're released? So that's sort of the equation that they're dealing with.
So Zusha, let's talk about a point you brought up earlier, and that is that we're seeing crime go down across the nation during the pandemic.
Yeah, so we took a look at some of the biggest cities, and while, you know, data on crime in America is not always up to date and that great, most of the big cities that we took a look at have seen violent crime and property crime go down in the first week since a lot of these cities shut down. And the reason that police are telling us is basically you have fewer people out on the street at the moment. However, cops are very concerned that crime could go up in the coming weeks, especially when you have sort of volatile combination of mass layoffs, you have a bunch of businesses closed, you have, you know, people getting kind of desperate. So cops are worried that there's going to be more burglaries of businesses and break-ins of businesses and that sort of stuff. They're also worried that there could be more domestic violence as more people are stuck at home for a longer period of time. But so far, we're so early in this that we haven't seen those happen yet.
So let's turn to policing now and how that's changed during the coronavirus pandemic in terms of the focus. Ben, what can you say about that?
In New York City, the police are being tasked with fighting the virus in addition to their usual job of fighting crime. In the first week of the city's response to the virus, the police here in New York conducted 66,000 different visits to public spaces and businesses to make sure that measures to contain the virus were being observed, including a ban on dining in restaurants and prohibitions against gatherings in parks. So this is a new role for the police here that they're undertaking in addition to the usual crime fighting stuff that they do.
Zusha, what about in California? How have you seen the focus of policing shift during the pandemic?
Well, across the country, one thing we're seeing is that police are trying to keep their distance. You know, trying to social distance was kind of a hard thing if you're a cop, right? You're in the car with the criminals, you're in the car with your police partner. When you arrest someone, you got to put your hands on them. So what can they do? What they can do is direct their officers not to make arrests for low-level crimes. And that's what they're doing. They're saying, you know, if you catch someone doing something like, you know, graffiti or whatever it might be, they say just cite them and release them and have as little contact as you can. I mean, cops are going to be catching this virus and spreading it because they're constantly interacting with the public. So the idea there is try to cut down on contacts. So we're seeing fewer lower level arrests.
Another thing that we've seen is large numbers of police officers being infected with the virus. There were about 3,000 officers who were out sick as of Thursday, and that's about three times the normal amount for the NYPD. So there's many officers who have been infected already in New York City.
And that brings up a key point here. How are police departments working to protect police and other law enforcement officials who are part of the essential workforce during this time? You mentioned a lot are calling out sick in New York. How is that playing out across the country?
Yeah, I mean, the police are struggling, much like the medical profession, with getting the supplies they need. There's a lot of places where they don't have enough face masks. It appears that a lot of them have the gloves and the hand sanitizer, but the face masks seem to be in short supply, so that's a problem. But in some places we've heard, you know, at roll call, cops, they all line up together there. Some of them are social distancing during roll call, trying to sanitize the cars as much as they can. And like I said, they're trying to keep further away from some of the criminals as well. But it's kind of a hard situation. It's just a job you can't do from home and you can't do from 6 feet away.
All right, Wall Street Journal reporters Zusha Ellenson and Ben Chapman, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
And finally, we've been asking for your questions about the coronavirus, and we're bringing in our reporters and experts to answer them here on the podcast. Our question today comes from Luke Otto from Chicago, Illinois. He's curious about how other countries' economies affect our own during the pandemic.
We understand the positive, seemingly positive impacts that the domestic measures for both monetary and fiscal policy will and may have on the U.S. economy. But as we all are aware, the U.S. economy is not a simply domestic economy. It's a global economy. So how may other countries and other continents' economies impact trade potentially and other economic factors that may impact the U.S. economy in the coming weeks and months?
For an answer, we turn to our international economics correspondent, Josh Zumbrun.
You think about a typical natural disaster, you know, a hurricane that hits Florida or a, you know, tsunami that hits Southeast Asia. Usually these things only affect one region of the country or region of the world, and everyone else is kind of still going and able to help pull that region along. And right now that's not happening. There's not the strong region that's able to help everyone else out. And so every country is having to really scramble to get the coronavirus under control and then get its own economy restarted. And one of the reasons it's going to be much more difficult than a typical situation is because there's not that strong man to help pull things along. I mean, that's important for the U.S. too. You know, you think about the financial crisis of 2008, one of the things that kind of helped pull the world out of that was actually the strength of China's economy at the time. But we don't have, you know, there's no strong Chinese economy right now. There's no strong American economy right now. No one is in that strong position, and it's what makes this such a hard situation.
Do you have a question about the coronavirus? Leave us a voicemail at 315-992-8298. We also have that number in the show description. We'll try to answer as many of your questions as we can. And that's what's news for this Friday afternoon. We'll be back on Monday in the morning and the afternoon. If you like our show, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.